Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to our second Department of Public Safety Subcommittee meeting. Today we'll be with House members only. Today is February 5th, and it's approximately 5 after 10 in the morning, February 5th, 2013. We have present a partial committee, but I assume it will be gathering more members as time goes on. To my left is Representative Feige and Representative Tarr, myself, Representative Edgman. Typical ground rules, we ask everyone to please turn the cell phones off. And just a quick housekeeping item, our next meeting for this subcommittee will be on Thursday. It'll be the same room, and the topic will be the Council for Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And an additional note is that we'll be moving the state troopers presentation from our earlier canceled meeting to the February 14th meeting. So with that, Commissioner, if you want to come to the table and bring your staff with you and introduce yourselves, and we'll get the hearing underway.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Masters, Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. At the table with me in assisting with this presentation is Admin Services Director Jeff Hoover for the Department of Public Safety, as well as Captain Steve Arlo. He's the current commander for the VPSO program. We have a PowerPoint presentation prepared to guide us through some of the discussion. Certainly, we're open to questions as we go along. As a introduction into the VPSO component into our budget and certainly the subsequent requests, the VPSO program is a long-standing program within the Department of Public Safety. It's been in existence for just over 30 years. The number of VPSOs in rural communities has fluctuated over those years. The VPSO in rural Alaska is a vital component to public safety that helps DPS meet its mission and provide safety in those communities that have very little law enforcement capacity and capability, or in the most rural areas of the state. The VPSO program in the more recent years, and I'm talking probably the last 4 years, has been a key component of the governor's initiative on sexual assault and domestic violence. With the key piece of the initiative is to put a law enforcement officer in every community in Alaska that desires one. Many communities that fit within the VPSO program structure and if we're authorized by statute to place them. The importance of a VPSO, just to further highlight it, in 2003-2004, we had the University of Alaska Justice Center take a look at all of our sexual assault domestic violence cases, and they came up with some conclusions in regards to how we respond to sexual assault and domestic violence in rural areas, in urban areas as well. And some of the data that came out of that study was very interesting for us and gleaned a little bit more insight on the importance of having VPSOs in rural communities. And one of the statistical pieces of data that came out of that was that in communities that have a VPSO, there's been nearly a 40% reduction in the level of serious physical injury due to felony assault. And another interesting bit that came out of that study was that in cases that were reported to the state troopers for sexual assault and sexual abuse of a minor, the likelihood that those cases were later accepted for prosecution by the district attorney's office was 3.5 times greater when the case was initially reported or responded to by a VPSO. More recently, we've been looking into whether or not there's other impacts into rural areas of the state, and one of those is whether or not there's an impact on suicide by having a VPSO in the community. And initial data that's coming forward now is that there is a statistically significant component or verification that is in fact the case, that having a VPSO in a community also affects other health and safety issues in the community, including the rates of suicide. Under the current program, there are a number of grantees. Most of these are regional nonprofit corporations. We have one that is not, and that's the Northwest Arctic Borough. And that change in the Northwest Arctic used to be the Manelic Manpower and then later the Manelic Association. And then under a law that was the legislature passed several years ago, it allowed the municipality in the region, which was the Northwest Arctic Borough in this case, to be the grantee and administer the program in an area where a nonprofit was either not able to or elected not to. Now, this is the list on this page is a list of all of the grantees. Currently, as it sits today, our FY13 funding allows us to get to 116 VPSOs. Earlier in the year, we had over 100 filled. This 92 positions filled is what we currently have today in 80 communities. The just as we hit that, there's highs and lows in recruiting VPSOs, and there's certainly attrition, which we'll talk in a lot more detail later on. At this point, we're on a fairly low point in that cyclic nature of hiring and turnover. VPSOs are present in 13 boroughs and census areas. This next number is a little bit dated. We're closer to about 80 communities that have a population of over 50 that are currently without any sort of law enforcement. Of the VPSO grantees for 2013, this slide depicts how the grants administered from the program are allocated to the nonprofits and the Northwest Arctic Borough. This next slide depicts the number of positions that are currently allocated under the program to each of those nonprofits. The blue line is the total number that they're authorized under the contract. The red bar shows the number that are currently filled out of those grantees. The historical budget picture for the VPSO program looking back to FY 2008 is depicted on this next slide. The blue is the total funds in DPS that are within the operating budget that are dedicated to the VPSO program. And the red is the amount of that blue line that is actually going to the grantees.
Commissioner, while we have a pause, we'd like to welcome Representative Foster here to the committee hearing. Thank you.
This slide here depicts the historically back to 1993, the number of hires within the program and also the number of turnovers within the program. As you look at this chart, I think it's important to point out that as we, particularly from 2006, 7, and 8, and to more recent, that this chart shows in percentages. So you have to keep in mind that we're also increasing the number of VPSOs, particularly, for example, from 2008, we had 45 VPSOs, 2013, we had just nearly 100. So the percentages, when you look at the turnover rates, it's important to look at it in that context as well. Another thing I'd like to point out on this slide, if you look at FY03, 04, 05, you'll see that there's a several-year period in there where there was significant turnover and very few hires. If you look at the later years, you'll see that we've been able to turn that around, and you see significant hires with lower turnover rates.
Question, Representative Feige?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. More of an observation. It really does go kind of relates back to the price of oil and the amount of production. 0304, prices in the toilet.
The
state doesn't have any money to spend. So,
historically, through the chair, historically, those years, FY02, 03, 04, were also years of significant reductions in the VPSO program. We saw several nonprofits eliminated from the program, and we saw significant reductions in the number of positions that were available at that time.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see in the coming up slides, you're going to talk a little bit more about recruitment. But in terms of the turnover piece, are you doing an exit interview, tracking what the problem is with why there's such high rates of turnover?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, we have an idea within the program of what some of the reasons for departure were. The employees are actually employees of the nonprofit corporation, and they, to some extent, may or may not do exit interviews. And we haven't historically required them to do exit interviews and turn that information over to us. Mm-hmm. Anecdotally, we know probably we have a fair idea of the reasons. Some are personal in nature. Some are, just not suited for the job. Some are disciplinary. Some are misconduct related. Some are performance related with the issues between them and their employers.
Commissioner, we got Representative Foster and then Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What are the top three things, or the first three things that come to your mind that we as the legislature can do to help reduce that turnover? And I think obviously pay is probably, one of them, but I guess can in addition to that.
I think there's a fundamental need for some changes to happen within the program, and one of the things, and you'll see this in some of the subsequent slides, is that over the last couple of years, and certainly today, status quo for us is not an acceptable operating condition. We're looking for ways to improve the VPSO program. We're looking at ways to increase training. We're looking at ways that the mentoring and support both from the troopers and also from the communities can be improved. We're looking at structural changes potentially within the program itself and how the program is not only structured but administered, to see whether or not, all right, take a look at that to see whether or not changes could take place. I think at this point, if I had to take a look at the, if I was looking at the program and I was looking at the current situation and knowing what I know, I would look at it and say probably the number one thing that we've got to figure out how to work on is making that position a position that is looked at by an individual as a potential job or a career path, and then looking at what keeps the VPSO in the position or what could keep a VPSO in that position so they stay longer. We've been working very hard over the past couple of years with salary and wage adjustments and assisting the nonprofits and assuring that there's a proper level of benefits that go with the job as well, and then also we have an escalating pay scale for longevity and some incentives in that nature. But there still is the need for us, I think, to figure out what other things can we do that will make that job something that somebody wants and wants to hold on to, not necessarily just for a short period of time.
Thank you.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, we go back to slide 6 real quick.
Which one is 6? Oh, there 6. We go.
On there where you say the grants, are these grants that are coming in like in the terms of receipts via federal grants, or are these grants that your department is issuing to the nonprofits, which then turn basically goes this way and then comes back to the actual VPSO?
That's a good question. In this case, these don't reflect receipts. The only this is the operating budget for the VPSO program. So the receipts for the department are all GF. This is GF dollars in our operating budget. The red portion depicts what that percentage is or what that amount is that goes to the nonprofits for administering the program. So we call them grants or contracts to the nonprofits, and that's the dollar and percentage amounts shown.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
The money that goes out in grants then to the nonprofit, how much do they skim off the top before it goes to the actual officer?
I would say they skim nothing off the top, but there is a...
There's usually an allowance.
Oh, there is, and I understand your question. I was just making light of the skim remark. But there is some program dollars that are actually going directly to some of the overhead costs, and then there is also... what's called a indirect rate. Mm-hmm. That indirect rate is capped and set at 15%. So the dollars that we give the program, each of the programs, 15% of that is on top of the program direct costs. So the funds that we give them for personal services for the VPSO, personal services for the nonprofit coordinator, direct costs for travel or equipment and things like that, when those dollars are given to the nonprofit, their 15% is automatically added on to that as part of that indirect rate.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. Given that there's that 15%, wouldn't it be more efficient in terms of dollars per individual spent to just have the VPSO be employed directly by the department?
Ultimately, when you look at the total cost of the program, I would say it would be much more expensive to have VPSOs as state employees for a variety of different reasons. One of the, and some people will call it the Achilles heel and the beauty of the VPSO program, is its three-pronged nature and having the community have some skin in the game, the nonprofit has some skin in the game, and the state have skin in the game. The nonprofits, as the employers, they will also look for other funding sources, CTAS grants, for example, from the federal government or some other grant programs. Some have got COPS grant funding to help support some of the infrastructure needs of the VPSOs. So that piece potentially could go away. The communities themselves provide infrastructure, although we are using program funds to assist them as best we can, particularly the ones that don't have funding coming in for those. But that piece probably would likely go away, and I think there would be a shift in expectations that the state would provide 100% of all funding for a VPSO in a community. So not only the training and the salaries and the wages and the equipment, but also the facilities, the housing, and so forth.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks.
President Tarr.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple quick things. So the difference between the blue and the red line are the actual administrative costs then that the department bears for the program and grant administration for the department responsibilities?
Through the chair, the largest portion of that gap is personal services, some travel, some other expenses related to that. For example, the Captain Arlo's salary is included in that gap portion, as well as a sergeant that's dedicated to the program, the DARE program coordinator, and a clerk that works with the DARE coordinator is also in that funding, that piece as well.
Thank you.
And Commissioner, while we're we've got a pause here. I just want to follow up on a question that Representative Tarr had asked earlier, because it's a question that I had asked, I think, in our initial meeting, and that was about the benefit of doing an exit interview and what benefit that might provide, realizing that you know, a lot of these communities are far-flung, and you sort of have a basic idea of what the dynamics are. But it just occurs to me, and as we talk to some of the regional nonprofits about the VPSO program, because we're starting to get some inquiries, you know, we'll ask about that on our end as well. But it just occurs that you wonder if some kind of a standard form that each non-for-profit is required to sort of go through in terms of tracking these ex-VPSOs down and getting that information that maybe might get some, you know, trend analysis. I think Representative Foster was kind of alluding to that, some data that has any continuums that might be out there. Your response in terms of the sort of the practical implications of doing this, because, again, you kind of already know on one hand, but on the other hand, is there one that overrides another and so on and so forth?
Well, Mr. Chairman, actually, we took your comments from an earlier meeting to heart, and we've already submitted that idea or concept to the program coordinator as well. And that's something that I think could easily be built into, it was your suggestion, built into the contractual requirements of the administration of the grants, the reporting requirements. That it's just something that currently is not built into those. And we have an opportunity to do that now with discussions on how these upcoming contracts are going to look.
And I bring that up because I I don't know, it was 7-8 years ago, an old friend of mine, I happened to meet him in the Unalaska airport. He was taking a prisoner from Akutan into Anchorage, and lo and behold, on the trail last fall, I met him. He was in the Bethel region in one of the communities, I think, in the lower Yukon. And so we talked for about an hour, and he bent my ear on sort of the challenges and the benefits of his experience and just a whole range of things, and it was pretty fascinating. I mean, it's a pretty complex picture, and it's not something you can just sort of put down as A, B, C, D, and E, and F. For some, perhaps, but not for all of the situations. It's a very challenging position to be in, first and foremost. Make no bones about it. Some of these communities, there's family factors and the smallness of the community, and just I see the Mr. Arlo nodding his head. I can only imagine the stories that he might have were we to spend some time offline on the individual circumstances. Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was going to be my second point. I was writing notes. But also, I think it would give us an opportunity to see among the grantees who's administering the program in the most effective way. Maybe we could develop some kind of best practices among new grantees, or maybe there'd be a reason to consider, you know, just like the, you know, with the law that changed, who could become a grantee, maybe some of those responsibilities aren't in the appropriate place if they're not doing a good job with the program, and, you know, there's a trend of high rates of turnover.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, through the chair, I think fundamentally, this program has been in existence for over 30 years. That, and the concepts of how it's administered and how it functions is really a product of a little bit of evolution, but based 30 years ago at its inception. The standards of programs at the time is much different than they would be today. If the program started today, it would probably be started differently with the different sets of structures and reporting practices and a different, probably a different set of some of the administration pieces of, and oversight pieces of it as well. It's a very lean program in the sense, certainly on the department side, regarding the number of personnel that are dedicated specifically to it. We've been working on several components of that over the last couple of years. One of those was the addition of VPSO support troopers. As we added VPSOs into the program, that we kept pace by adding some support components to go with that. Some of the administration pieces within Steve Arlo's office certainly could be looked at as well. But that's one of the things that I alluded to earlier regarding a organizational review and audit of the VPSO program, as well as an audit of some of the administration functions, as well as some of the training components and pieces on that we've been doing. And we, over the last 2 years, have been working with the McDowell Group on a specific study to take a look at that and help us with where we're going to go in the future and how we deal with some of the issues that you're describing.
Okay, continuing on.
What I'd like to do maybe for these next 3 or 4 slides is have Captain Arlo actually detail some of the things that we are doing on the recruitment side and on the program side that I've talked a little bit about, but he could probably talk in more detail.
Thank you, Commissioner. Good morning. I'm Captain Steve Arlo with the VPSO program, work for the Department of Public Safety. I've been in this position about 7 years. I'm fairly familiar with the program and the workings and the history behind the concept. The slide that you're looking at now is talking about one of the passions that we have currently in the program, that is recruitment. We obviously know this is an important component. We take it seriously, and we've invested a lot of our resources toward recruitment. And to highlight some of those things, we make appearances at most major functions within Alaska, both AFNs, the state fairs, any kind of job core-related presentations, if it's at the college, or even in the smaller villages, if they have a school job fair like in Mnemonic or some of the hubs, we'll show up to those and we'll have a display board and we'll have VPSOs and troopers presenting the program to the community and to those future applicants. We do troopers and VPSOs both do presentations in schools for high school students. So we start at a very early age trying to get recruitment looked at. Just to give you an idea of some of the professional publications we've done in recruitment, we have two brochures that one is a brochure that outlines if you're a community and you're interested in the VPSO program, this brochure is given to the community and it explains all the issues that you need to consider as a community before you take this endeavor. There's another publication that we give strictly to people that are interested in being a VPSO, and it highlights where you would go to find out more about the VPSO program. And then we have two other brochures we've just recently developed talking about, and I'll get into it a little bit more later, is our outreach with Alaska Youth Academies and the Alaska, what we call the LECC, Law Enforcement Cadet Corps. Both those publications are just more informationals professionally done to be able to hand out at these presentations. Specifically on recruitment, the Department of Public Safety has a website, and within that website there's a link to the VPSO webpage that has a very interesting, if you've never visited it, I'd encourage you to do so. There's about a 20-minute video that we had professionally done a few years ago that basically follows a brand new VPSO into the program through the academy, what it would be like to be in an academy, and into the field. And we don't sugarcoat it. We let them see what it would be like. If they're interested in this position, they'll be able to have that opportunity before before we invest a lot of money into it. They'll have a good understanding of what they're getting into. And you can, obviously the website's up there. Briefly talking about the Alaska Youth Academy, that's something that has been introduced about 2 years now. We're going into our third summer where we have camps located around the state. Currently we have one in Beryl, one in Bethel, and we're expanding into Hooper Bay, Emonic, and Fairbanks. Just last week I was up talking to 10 of our chiefs, and they're interested in setting one up in Fairbanks. It really works well. For 7 days, we bring in the U.S. Marshals, the state troopers, VPSOs, any kind of law enforcement or public safety entity in the region that wants to introduce kids, both men and women, to careers in public safety. They don't necessarily have to be in law enforcement. There's other opportunities. So we want to kind of introduce that concept to the young men and women. And there's an outlying theme throughout the camp about choices, life choices. It's so critical that these students make good choices, because it'll affect, as we all know, their adult years and where their opportunities and careers will be. If they make poor choices, they're going to limit their opportunities. So these kind of themes are throughout our camps. Just in the 2 years, we've shown a real great success. We've developed Facebook pages for each session so the kids can communicate with each other and with instructors. So that's our mechanism to track our progress. So that's been really that new technology that we're all challenged with at times. And then the Law Enforcement Cadet Corps, which is based in Sitka, which was the Mount Edgecombe concept, where students obviously from all over the state come to Mount Edgecombe. The Academy and Commissioner Masters, they have a staff there that is focused on outreach to those kids, and they provide a really nice course once a week. Kids from that are interested in learning about public safety will get to experience an evening with the troopers at the Academy and with this particular program manager. And then they'll do a summer camp for a couple of weeks. And we've expanded that Mount Edgecombe concept in Sitka out to Galena, because they have a very similar program there with a hub school that brings in students from all around that region. So we're reaching out to those potential applicants there. In regards to recruitment, the nonprofits also have websites where they provide a opportunity to learn about the VPSO program, what's available, and what openings the nonprofits have. Interesting, we've started a relationship with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a federal entity, more so just to understand their training and their challenges. Both the commissioner, myself, and the director of AST have visited some of their facilities, and they've reciprocated. And we've really come to find out that we're looking in mirrors for the most part. They have the same challenges down in Low 48 and on reservation country as we do in Alaska. So we're just kind of working together and trying to pair up our ideas and see where it leads. Also, with regard to recruitment, it's our fundamental belief that the best way to recruit in our agencies, both in the Alaska State Troopers and in the VPSO program, is with VPSOs and troopers. They visit with potential applicants in the communities and can answer questions and kind of just shed some light on the career. Any opportunity that I have in my support troopers that the commissioner was talking about earlier, we have support troopers stationed around Alaska. Any opportunity we have to go before a radio station, and believe it or not, radio in rural Alaska is still a big deal. People listen to the radio, and it's a good mechanism for us to get out and spread the word. We are doing great efforts in recruitment, and I'm proud of the work that we're doing there.
And I'll interject just for a minute before I go to the next slide. I wanted to back up to the LECC component because I think this is a good example of cooperation and collaboration between the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Education, and the Department of Labor on this effort. And this is a somewhat, words escaping me here, but like a junior ROTC type program. We have a week-long mini academy basically at our Sitka Academy. We bring the kids in over from Mount Edgecombe High School, and then they continue on in youth leadership and some self-leadership led activities as well. So it gives us an opportunity to expose kids in from rural Alaska and looking at law enforcement as a career. So we don't see this giving us immediate results on our recruitment, but in a couple of years, this is likely to pay dividends for us.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on those youth programs, they sound fantastic, and it sounds like they're focused right now in more rural communities, but we always say Anchorage is the biggest village, right? So I'm just wondering, does any of that information get shared in, you know, the bigger cities? I know in the area I represent, there are a lot of families that, you know, have transitioned to Anchorage, but one of the reasons is job opportunities, and so, you know, given that opportunity, they might choose to go back to their home village and take on one of those positions.
Well, during the recruitment programs, yes, they are. That information is shared, but this specific cadet and youth academy information, they're aware of it, but we don't do them in the Anchorage area, primarily because the way we administer this, or the way we do this, is we utilize local resources, and we don't have a lot of uniformed trooper resources in the urban areas, in Anchorage, for example, to be able to do something like this. But the troopers that are out in Bethel or Monick or in those areas, they volunteer for these type of assignments, so they're able to do that. Galena as well. Galena is going to be pretty well run by the school out there, but also by the local troopers.
Quick follow-up. If there were a student in the Anchorage area that was really interested in participating, is there a way for them to apply or be able to do that?
For the Alaska Youth Academy, there potentially could be, but we also do another program through the Fraternal Order of Alaska State Troopers, which is a CSI camp, where we bring them over to the crime lab, and they run a week-long summer camp as well.
Okay. Well, speaking of radio, and Captain, you hit it right on the nail. We, you know, everybody listens to public radio out in the bush, Alaska, but this would make for a great Talk of Alaska segment for sure if you guys haven't done that yet. It comes on every Tuesday, 10 o'clock in the morning, and everybody listens to it quite regularly. So.
Thank you. The next slide talks a little bit about, as Commissioner Masters had said earlier, is that status quo is unacceptable. We're looking at new concepts and new ideas. One of the things we did is in 2012, we hired a Juneau-based group called McDowell Group, and they did an independent evaluation of the VPSO program. And go ahead.
Can I interrupt you? Representative Foster had a question.
So sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just when we're talking about retention and so forth, and made me think about, as we talk about expanding out this program, the goal is to get a VPSO into every community that wants one. And that always kind of struck me as a little bit interesting, and I just assumed that everybody would want one. But I do know of one community that does not want one, and there's a little bit of a tangle within the community because some folks want it and some folks don't. And I know that the nonprofits administer the program, so I don't know how close you are to knowing how many communities don't want one, but what's your, do you have an answer on what you've seen in terms of how many? Is it prevalent? Is it rare?
Well, we could tag team this one a little bit. You're absolutely correct. There are some villages out there that absolutely don't want a VPSO, and there's some that are mixed where half the community may and half the community may not. To have a VPSO in a community, it takes community involvement, it takes community support. So it's difficult on the way we administer the program to put a VPSO in a community that does not want one. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we stop there, because we do work with the nonprofits closely in discussions with the communities, where we have VPSO program folks travel out to some of these communities to talk with them, talk about the benefits of having a VPSO in the community, and talk frankly about what they view as the negative aspects of it as well. In most cases, the communities see it as only a law enforcement position, and they think, oh, we're going to get busted if we have people in the community, but they don't see the other aspects of it. You know, the fact that the VPSO can work with the health aide on emergency medical, that they can help organize the volunteer fire department or even be responsible for the code red equipment that's in the community, and the search and rescue aspects of coordinating search and rescue from those communities as well. And those are some of the things that we try to help the communities understand. As far as the numbers or anything else, I'll defer to Captain Arlo.
Through the chair, I think, as the commissioner stated, the importance of having that community support is invaluable. If you were try to put a VPSO in a community that really didn't support it, it wouldn't be successful at all. And we've seen that. So if the community doesn't want one, I don't think it's going to be a healthy community, and there's going to be other issues that are going to come before us.
So I think the natural follow-up would be, what constitutes a community support? Is it a resolution from the governing authority, if it would be tribe or the municipality, or?
Through the chair, traditionally the nonprofit, along with one of these support troopers, will go out to a particular community and enter into a memorandum of agreement, and we'll sit down at the table, and they'll tell us what they think the VPSO program would do for them, and then we kind of agree on these topics. Sometimes they'll have some unique ideas that are great, and sometimes they'll have one that their expectations are more outside the boundaries of what we want. So this memorandum of agreement is a nice document that we use to keep everybody in line with how this program is going to be implemented in the community.
That's interesting. Has there been incidents where the MOA, as time goes on, proves that it doesn't represent the true community wishes, because, you know, the smart communities are notorious for having factions in some of them, you know?
Put Mr. it Chairman, slightly. I think just like in any government-type environment, certainly there'll be the representatives that are participating in the memorandum of agreement, but that doesn't mean all of the community is going to be totally supportive. And we do have communities that are split, but we like to think that things really are necessary for the community to step up, they will, and they'll support the VPSO. And as the commissioner said, the VPSO isn't just that law enforcement function. It's so many other things that once the community understands that, I think there's buy-in.
Okay. Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just, I feel like two McDowell study reports or studies have been mentioned here, one related to these new concepts. And has that been made available to us? I don't know if I missed that, but I would love to see that, if it can be made available. And then a second one is the one you're working on related to the high turnover rate. And is that true? They're two separate?
That's correct. There are two separate studies or reports that are being done as one project.
Okay.
It's currently in a final draft form that we're going back and forth with the group on. As soon as it's finalized, certainly we can share that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll continue on to kind of go into a little more detail about the McDowell Group findings. And the McDowell Group went out and queried all the participants, both the folks that run the program, including the commissioner, and troopers, VPSOs, community leaders, anybody in the community. And they kind of established that this program is very unique. It's it stood the test of time for a reason. It's a challenge in rural Alaska to provide public safety, and they felt that this was a very good program and was worthy of continuing the program and spending the resources and energies into the program. They provided us with some guidance, and we kind of, as any strategic plan, if you've participated in one, you know, they gave us some four key components we need to think about. Strengthening management, I take that as contracts and just relationships. The recruitment component was obviously a big one, a number two priority. And improving the public understanding of the program and building community ownership and capacity. And I believe all those four that they discovered to be important, I agree with as well. I think some of the concepts that they talk about in the strategic plan was thinking outside the box. And this slide depicts some of the things we're looking at right now, which is not the traditional way that the program was designed 30 years ago. It includes a roving type position. And a roving position would be a concept like a Kotzebue, for example, would have two or three VPSOs assigned there, and they would rove out to those communities and support law enforcement and other public safety functions. That VPSO could live in a community hub that has infrastructure. They could provide a home for their family and feel a little more comfortable than going out to the smallest of villages, which in many cases, some of the small villages don't even have a house that they could provide a VPSO. And so that's, we think, is going to be a good mechanism for recruitment. We're looking at the two-week on, two-week off concept that law enforcement is practicing in the North Slope and that we have started in DPS in places like Selawik and Emonic. We're hoping that this might attract a new applicant pool, maybe some retired people with lots of skills might be interested in doing a two-week on, two-week off and continue a lifestyle in urban Alaska, but yet provide a needed service in rural. Other things we're thinking about, part-time seasonal VPSOs, areas that have a large influx of people. I could think right now like a Bristol Bay area where you have a large influx of people during a certain season. We need more law enforcement or more public safety opportunities during that time. And quite frankly, maybe a particular person might not want a full-time job, might want a seasonal job. So it's a new pool that we might be tapping into. Some job sharing opportunities. Maybe there's somebody that only wants to work part-time and we split the duties. Then again, the reverting back to the concept of investing in the future with LECC, Law Enforcement Cadet Corps, and summer camps, that's going to be our application pool in the future. It's a long-term investment. We might not reap the benefits right now, but I think by doing this in 3 to 5 years, we'll start seeing a different pool.
Chairman?
Representative Foster?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to express my support for this and happiness to see, you know, kind of the thinking outside the box here. And it's not something that I would have thought of, but it makes sense as I went out to a number of villages, and not just in one village, but in a number of village, different people saying that they wouldn't mind having somebody come into their village who was not from there, because sometimes you get into a situation where somebody who's lived there and who's grown up there, and it's, say, you're only a community of 150 people and you're related to half of those people, you know, half of the people in the community who they're not related to start to think that that person's showing favoritism or it's their friend and they're not going to, you know, come down on them and for bootlegging or whatever it might be. So I think this is a very interesting concept, and I just wanted to say that I'm glad that you're implementing that. So thank you.
The next slide indicates VPSO funding flexibility. It kind of touches on, through the chair, what Representative Foster just kind of touched on about the difficulty of doing this job in a rural environment, especially if you're from that region. What we have found to be true is a lot of these communities that we want to put law enforcement in have little infrastructures to support it, even though they would want one. Once again, I talked earlier, there's not a house available, there's not an office available. Who is going to provide that? We would like to think that through this VPSO program, this program has many facets to it. We have to be cognizant of the fact that just because we have a VPSO dressed up and trained doesn't mean we have a healthy program. We've got to get all those components lined together. And so we need some flexibility with the funding to provide some of those things for offices and places to cells to house prisoners prior to transporting them into a hub. I'll give you some quick real field examples. I'll get a call on a particular day, and it'll be from the coordinator saying the VPSO's office heater just broke, and it's no longer good, and it's 20 below. Can you help us out, Captain Arlo? So I've got to try to find some mechanism to get a heater out there to that office as soon as I can. So the ability to have some flexibility with funding in this program is a definite benefit. Reprogramming these funds to the nonprofits to support them on examples like that are crucial to keep the program healthy and moving forward. It's also, if you're going to attract a pool of applicants, they're going to want to work in a professional location, and if they know that they're going to go to an office that doesn't have heat and running water and no jail, who wants to sign up for that job? So it's important that we support that infrastructure.
Let me also add, and we're when we talk about funding flexibility, we're not necessarily always talking about state GF funds as well. We assist some of the regions and communities in applying for other funds as well. One I mentioned at the very beginning, it was called CTAS, which is the Combined Tribal Solicitation, which is a federal grant funding. We've assisted several regional corporations, for example, BBNA, we've assisted AVCP, and several others, but I believe those two actually received fairly substantial CTAS federal grant funds that can be leveraged against with a VPSO program. So they may provide some vehicles and equipment and things of that nature as well. So this funding flexibility within the program allows us to take an opportunity with some of the nonprofits or the communities and other grants or funds that they may have available, where it may not reach all the way. For example, they may have 75% of the funds necessary to build a public safety building, and they need a little bit more to either complete portions of it or assist them with portions of that. So things like that are good opportunities to help communities get some of these infrastructures in place. Some other examples of some of the funds from the VPSO program have been to help communities rehab existing structures to make offices habitable, replacing a roof, putting in some electrical wiring, doing some plumbing work, assisting with a heater, things of that nature.
Joe, and this is a little bit of an odd question, maybe even a silly question, but are there instances, like when you go to a hospital, for example, the nurse seems to know a lot more than the doctor does. We've all maybe encountered that, but where VPSOs are in fact mentors to incoming state troopers.
Absolutely. And I can remember doing that with a trooper that used to come into Unalakleet. VPSOs, there's a wide variety of skills and capabilities with the VPSOs that are hired. And some of them have vast knowledge of the regions that they're in, not only of maybe some of the public safety issues and problems, but also with the people that inhabit that area, or as well, for example, search and rescues, assisting troopers and helping them learn how to run the river even in a boat or on a snow machine, where, when not to move on ice or through different areas. So there's a lot of different areas that occurs.
Just another abstract question. Would there ever be a situation down the road with this program where a VPSO might act in the capacity of an undercover status, or may someday have their own Super Cub, or be able to get to other communities and have more of an expanded role?
Currently, as the program exists today, we could utilize a VPSO in an undercover capacity. We don't necessarily have the number of VPSOs necessary to be able to kind of extend that out, but that's something that's not against policies or anything like that. It just really hasn't been utilized that way, but it certainly could be utilized that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question about the suitable office and prisoner housing. Through the grant program, Most of the grantees are Native corporations. It's just the one that's the, you know, borough government. Do we have any requirement for them to provide funding or support for that? Or, do you know, is it all the money the state's giving them and federal money? Or, and is there an opportunity for some of that infrastructure support if that was a part of the program?
The way we currently have it structured, the community itself as a recipient of a VPSO is required to find the suitable office space in a holding cell. Oftentimes the community is not able to do that. The nonprofit, and in the Northwest Arctic's case, the borough and the state often we try to find ways to facilitate that happening, particularly in communities that they just don't have the funds to do it. The Northwest Arctic Borough, for example, has applied for COPS funding to support VPSO infrastructure, and also VPOs as well. They've to get second officers or more capacity out in some of the villages as well. So the opportunities are there. The VPSO program, certainly we have access to certain funds. The nonprofits and the communities have access to certain funds or have opportunities to get different types of funding. And sometimes they can apply for grant funding, for example, that the state cannot apply for. Mm-hmm. And that by working together, we can get some things accomplished.
Do you feel like then when we're adding positions that we should almost be including some kind of capital increment with that to sort of match, you know, a new position, a new community, that that's a sort of cost that we should be including or recognizing separately?
We do request some funding. Mm-hmm. As well, we certainly have some of the one-time increments that are built into the VPSO requests for new positions. We also have equipment and supplies request that is requested in our capital budget.
Okay.
As well. But that only allows us to meet partial needs for the communities that are out there. We also have a funding increment in the AHFC budget for dedicated housing for communities, to assist communities and regional housing authorities to build public safety housing that's dedicated for VPSOs. And there's been the last 3 years running a $1 million increment in the AHFC budget for that, which has been taken advantage of.
Manicotic is one of those communities, are they not?
That's correct.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just continue a few more points on reference to flexibility. This program, if you looked back 30 years ago and compared the training, what the uniform looked like and some of the duties required of a VPSO compared to now, you'll see it's a completely different perspective. These VPSOs are very well trained. They've got great opportunities, very good equipment, good support from our troopers oversights. And I think we've established a field training program which was never in existence before that mirrors what the troopers go through, just a smaller version of it. So we get a good sense of is our training working? Are they capable of being independent in the community and doing a public safety service? And again, those kind of added costs, we need some flexibility with the program as well. And investing in the youth applications that we talked about earlier with these programs, the youth camps and LECC programs.
Okay. And Jeff's been real silent over here, so I'll let him take the next couple of slides.
Mr. Chairman and the committee, Jeff Hoover, Admin Services Director for the department. This is just a quick snapshot of the FY14 operating budget, and as you can see, most of the funding is going out through grants. It's a pretty lean operation as far as personal services. Some of the money that is in capital outlay and commodities and is money that the state is administering directly for the grantees. We are making the purchases of equipment that directly benefits the grantee. The next slide is the FY14. Significant changes. We have the continuing initiative for adding the 15 VPSOs in rural areas in the total of $2.67 million. This does include one-time costs in the equipment line and for training for 409, plus the ongoing cost of 2.2 million. And I think we talked about the positions, they were spread across the grantees. In the budget, you'll notice that the two separate components, the VPSO support and the VPSO contracts, were combined. This is to help streamline the program to make it more efficient. It's all under one program component. So it helps us administratively to use the money as quickly and as best we can.
President Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Years ago, the Army sent me into graduate school, and part of that deal was that I think it was 2 years of graduate school, and I had to stay in the Army for 6 years afterwards. And that was basically for the Army to recoup its cost of the additional training. As it was, I served a year and then was able to buy out my education afterwards. But we do have a high turnover in the program. And I certainly recognize the difficulties you have in keeping personnel, and a lot of it, quite frankly, is out of your control. But it does cost money to train these guys, to bring them into sort of the law enforcement arena. What would be the effect of requiring, maybe not the individuals directly, but the nonprofits that support them, basically kind of guarantee that they're going to be around a while before we make that investment in their training so that they can provide that service to their community? Is that something that's feasible, or is the recruitment that difficult that may artificially hinder the number of folks that we can bring in?
Well, my initial thought or feeling on it is it probably would cause a pretty chilling effect on the number of people that are willing to take the positions at a time when we're already struggling to keep those positions coming in the door. One of the issues is whether or not, for example, the training is comportable to other professions or to other jobs. And currently, as it's situated today, although we are making some program changes within training to allow more flexibility in this, currently, as it's just VPSOs that have received VPSO training, that training doesn't comport to a police officer certificate that they could take to Nome Police Department or some other job. So it's pretty specific just to this job. So there's not a benefit beyond that piece. I would also suspect that the nonprofit corporations that are administering the program probably would take a look at this, and it would probably have a chilling effect on them on potentially willingness to even move forward with the program.
Okay, fair enough.
Through Mr. Chairman, through the committee, this is just a slide that shows the budgeted positions and how it has the filled positions did dip a little bit in the current year. So we've talked about how we're trying to improve the retention and the recruitment to increase the number of filled positions.
And you know, I know that Mr. Chairman, that a big question is, if we do receive an additional increment for more positions, are we going to be able to fill the positions that we already have capacity for, as well as new positions? And that is it would require an effort on all of our parts, a significant effort to make that happen. I can tell you that currently, as it sits today, because we do background investigations on the candidates for these positions, currently as it sits today, the nonprofits have authority to proceed with hires on 10 individuals, and we are looking at 11 additional backgrounds that we're working on today as well. So we have a potential best case scenario within the next
month or so to be able to get 21 more positions hired. Certainly, that number, more realistically, obviously, is going to be less than that. But that gives you an idea of the current capacity of where we're at on hiring if the corporations move today on some of these positions.
Mr. Can we get a list of communities that don't have a VPSO? Again, I think you provided that a couple years ago. Last year it was in front of the Finance Committee. But I think that'd be interesting to look at. And a comment to the subcommittee members looking at the list last year, it was pretty interesting that some of these communities, I think Savunga, Atka, I mean, communities that are not just distant, they're way out there.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we maintain an informal list of communities that we base off of the Community Commerce and Economic Development list. That lists all communities in Alaska. And some of those aren't organized cities or villages, but we do maintain that list, and we try to keep it updated with information regarding whether there's a VPSO in that community, a VPO in that community, no law enforcement in that community, or whether it's directly patrolled, for example, some of the communities outside of established cities, we'll patrol with our patrol resources, like out of Fairbanks or out of Haines and things like that. So we do keep an unofficial or an informal list like that we can share. At times it's one point in time, and it's sometimes based on not official reporting data. For example, there's no official requirement for a community to report whether they have a VPO. So we get that information from the troopers that are out in the detachments based on their working knowledge of how many VPOs in a community there may be.
It'd also be interesting to know of these 67 communities of over 50 people without any law enforcement. I assume that there's a number of communities under 50 people as well, but it'd be interesting to correlate those communities with whether or not they have a school, what the community population has been doing, because we have a number of communities in Southwest Alaska that are, frankly, steadily declining. Mm-hmm. And at some point, may just end up being a summer camp for commercial fishing or subsistence or whatever it might be. That's something that we could certainly do on our own, but it strikes me that some of these communities may not want a VPSO because, I don't know if you'd said there wasn't a need for one, but Cold Bay doesn't have a VPSO, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think they want one. But really, do they need one? I mean, they're such a small community, and I've had that conversation going in and out of the community a few times that they basically said, hey, we don't need one here, We like driving without a driver's license and all that stuff that they can do.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think in our experience, certainly most of the listed communities on the list I told you about that are under 50 in population are generally fall in that category where there probably is not a need in most of those. There are some that are on that threshold of about 50 that are in areas that have seasonal influxes because of fishing and things of that nature. And they may or may not. The list that we have that we maintain, a lot of the communities are in the area of 75 to 150 in population or more.
Representative Charter, do you have
mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned earlier a university report. Are you talking about the interpersonal violence report that was done with Department of Justice, or was there another report?
Through the chair, in 2005, mm-hmm. the University of Alaska Justice Center did a very specific study for the Department of Public Safety on sexual assault, domestic violence, and sexual abuse of a minor cases, and how we worked with those. So it's a very specific study based on all of the 2003, 2004 cases from the troopers. And we can provide you links through the chair. We could provide links to that study.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're essentially at the end of the presentation, unless there's any other questions or comments. Our next meeting is Thursday. It's a council on, I can never get that right. Help me.
CDVSA?
Yeah. I can't even do that. We all know what it is. So thank you, Commissioner, and Captain Arlo and Mr. Hoover, and we'll see you on Thursday.